This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Fireborn by Rosaria Munda. Read for you by Christian Coulson and Candice Moll with Steve West. Prologue. Later, he would be known as the First Protector, and under his vision the city would transform. Serfs would be freed, schools would be built, and dragons would, for the first time, be ridden by commoners. Before that, he was the leader of the bloodiest revolution his people had ever seen. He never doubted that he would create a just city, nor did he doubt that the families of the old regime deserved to die. But he did, sometimes, regret the way it happened, the day the palace was finally overrun. He remembered in particular one of the ruling families, their tormentors still at work when he found them. The Dragon Lord had been kept alive, to watch. His youngest son was the only child left. A boy of about 7 or 8, his expression blank beneath a mask of blood. The remains of their family lay around them. "Stop this foolishness at once," the First Protector said, when he and his guard found them. The revolutionaries let go of the boy, whom they had been hurting, and began to protest. "This man is Leon Stormscourge. Don't you know what he's done?" But they fell silent when the Dragon Lord spoke from his knees on the blood-stained carpet. "My son," he said, in the language he and the First Protector shared. "Please, Atreus." The First Protector took a half-glance at the child. He said, "Leo will be looked after." He gave one of his guards a murmured order. The soldier started, hesitated, and then lifted the Dragon Lord's son in his arms. When the boy had been carried, limp and silent, from the room, the leader of the revolution knelt before the Dragon Lord. "Those animals," the Dragon Lord rasped. The First Protector did not disagree. Instead, he put a hand to the knife on his belt. When he met the Dragon Lord's gaze, it was in an unspoken question. The Dragon Lord closed his eyes and nodded. Then, to the First Protector's surprise, he spoke. "Your vision," he said. "Do you think it will ever be worth this, Atreus?" The First Protector drew his knife. "Yes," he said. The Dragon Lord's question returned to him often in the years that followed. Even as many of the other details of the revolution began to fade from his memory, he remembered Leon Stormscourge. Leon's son, on the other hand, was a detail he forgot. Chapter 1. Messages from the Ministry. 9 years later. Lee.
Morning is our favorite time to fly. Today, even with the tournament looming and the empty arena below us a reminder that soon we'll be watched, for the first time, by thousands, it's still possible to savor the city sprawled beneath a dragon's wings. When we pull tight on a turn, I glimpse one of Palor's black eyes, depthless, turned on me. The line between us, of shared emotions and thoughts that are usually latent in the saddle, goes taut. Yes. Today it begins. Today we'll rise. But in order to do that, I'll need a clear head. I gently extricate myself from Palor's simmering anticipation and refocus on the arena. Two other dragon riders fly with us, each riding one of the other two breeds. Chrissa and her skyfish are in the air above us, while Kor and his storm scourge glide below, bellowing ash over the arena stands. We're on our last rehearsal, this time with just the squadron leaders. I lift my voice over the wind. "You're taking her too low, Kor." Kor grunts, frustrated, and urges his storm scourge higher. We've rehearsed the choreography of the tournament's opening ceremony over and over with ministry officials, and every time, the question of how to demonstrate the might of the storm scourge breed becomes tricky. Before the revolution, the dragons of Storm Scourge House, of my family, were known for terrorizing the countryside. But in even older days, they were our island's greatest defense against aerial invasion. "They told us to fire low," says Kor. "Not that low. It's risky for the audience." Our dragons are immature, barely horse size, and can't yet breathe fire, but the smoke they produce can still burn. Krissa and her skyfish, long, slender, and pale enough blue to blend with the morning sky, circle above us. "You want to impress the people," she calls down to Kor, "not roast them." Kor waves a hand. "All right, all right." The fleet is still in training, dragons and riders both. Known now as guardians, the new regime's dragon riders are lowborn, commoners, even former serfs. No longer the sons of dragon lords. Except for me. Though I'm the only one who knows that. Because in the wake of the revolution, to be dragonborn is to be wanted for dead. I was born Leo, son of Leon, dragon lord of Storm Scourge House, and Drakarch of the Far Highlands. But since the orphanage, I've been Lee. Not even the first protector who saved my life and then welcomed me without recognition into his guardian program 2 years after that knows the truth. That a Storm Scourge tested into the meritocratic dragon riding program designed to replace everything his family stood for. Even though I know I'm lucky to be here, lucky to be alive, lucky to have escaped the orphanage, memories of the old life have a way of intruding and twisting. Especially today, as Palor and I circle above the palace arena, open to the public for the first time since the revolution. The old regime had tournaments here too. Tournaments I watched my father compete in, dreaming of the day it would be my turn. I lean forward and rest a gloved hand on Palor's silver-scaled neck as his wings, translucent in the morning light, tighten in a dive. Palor is an Aurelian, a smaller breed known for being careful and maneuverable. And the Aurelian formation for today's ceremony is the only one complex enough to require co-leaders. I can rehearse alone, but to do the thing properly I need... Annie. There she is. Another Aurelian, this one amber-toned, has emerged from the cave mouth at the base of the arena, and on her back rides my sparring partner, Annie. She and I have trained together for as long as we've been in the Guardian program, and we've known each other since the orphanage before that. It's a past life's worth of memories that we're both pretty good at not talking about. "Annie!" Krissa calls with a cheerful wave. "There you are!" "Lee's been flying like an idiot out here without you," Kor says. Palor and I fire ash downward. Kor dodges the stream with a bark of laughter. Annie's lips curve at Kor's remark, but instead of answering, she rolls seamlessly into formation opposite me, her dragon, Ayla, mirroring Palor's movements. Annie's red-brown braid hangs low on her back, her pale, freckled face set in concentration. I've thought of Annie as beautiful, strikingly beautiful for almost as long as I can remember, but I've never told her that. "Take it from the top," I suggest. There are calls of assent from the other three. We right ourselves only when the bell rings the hour. The arena below, the palace to one side, and the cast pillar supporting Pytho's keep on the other. The jagged rooftops, the plains stretching out to the sea. For a moment, I feel a protectiveness, almost a possessiveness of the city and island spread below. The vows that we took when we became guardians echo in my mind. All that I am belongs to Kallipolis. By the wings of my dragon, I will keep her. Today, 8 of the guardians will compete in the quarterfinal tournament for First Rider, commander of the aerial fleet. I'm one of those 8, along with Annie, Kor, and Krissa. Qualifying rounds have been going on among the 32 dragon riders for weeks. It will be the first time since the revolution that Kallipolis names a first rider, one of the few titles it's kept from the old regime. The dragons of the revolutionary fleet are finally old enough and their riders well enough trained to vie for a position that's been vacant since the revolution. For the other Guardians, the first rider tournaments are a chance to prove themselves. For me, it will be that and something more. Because first rider is a title I've wanted since before the revolution. It will be all the recognition, power, and respect that my family lost over the course of a single bloody month when I was 8 years old, regained. First rider. Distantly below, the bells of the palace clock tower are tolling. I rouse myself. We should get in for breakfast. Goran said he'd have the tournament bracket ready by then. We land on the Eyrie, the jutting stone platform that rises from the center of the arena, where we dismount, unsaddle our dragons, and dismiss them to their nests in the caves below. Back in the palace, we find the rest of the Guardian Corps, 30-odd students in all, trickling into the cloister refectory from the dorms. The walls of the refectory are bare stone, the windows high and narrow, breakfast the usual slightly burnt porridge. Though we are technically palace residents, we live in what were, before the revolution, servants' quarters.
You're up early.
Duck, Kor's younger brother, has scooted on his bench to make room for us where he's sitting with some friends. Though Duck and Kor share olive skin and wavy hair, in manner, they're opposites, Kor tending to scowl, where Duck wears an open smile. Annie slides comfortably onto the bench beside Duck. They're both 16, a year younger than most of us. While it was the first commonality that brought them together, they remained friends because Duck seemed to like the challenge. It's hard to get Annie to smile, and Duck's good at it. Duck lifts his spoon from his porridge and cocks it in Annie's direction.
Ready for your big day?
Annie snorts, but all the same, colour enters her cheeks. A rare glimpse of ambition she usually keeps close to the vest. She's hunching again. Always on the ground, Annie hunches, as if hoping to take up less space. It's a jarring contrast to her confidence in the air. Chrissa tells Duck, in the bracing voice she pulls out whenever she's encouraging riders in her squadron,
"Your big day too!"
Duck lifts his shoulders, grin flagging.
"Let's not get ahead of ourselves."
Like the four of us, Duck made it into today's quarterfinals. He'll do great, depending on how he handles his nerves and who he's up against.
Nervous, Dorian?
Speaking of which. Power, one of the qualifying Storm Scourge riders, has passed us on his way from the serving counter. He drapes an arm around Duck's shoulder, as if he were encouraging him, and flicks a spare palm over close-shaven black hair as he locks eyes with me. Power is around my height and weight, and this has always been the kind of calculation I make and can tell he's making when we look at each other. Duck has gone rigid.
"Get your hands off me," he says through gritted teeth.
Kor sets down his glass with a click on the hardwood table. I return my spoon to a resting position in the bowl of porridge. It's almost disappointing when Power withdraws his arm. He's become more careful in recent years.
"Jumpy, are we?"
He wanders back to the empty seat between Darius and Alexa, who have been watching our interchange apprehensively. The tension slides out of Duck's shoulders, and he makes a guttural noise of disgust.
"Sometimes," Kor muses, "I miss the days when patrician kids like Power got away with stuff, and it was up to us to keep them in line."
"I don't,"
Duck mutters. In the old regime, my family was among the ruling Dragonborn, and the patrician families like Power's were a tier below, wealthy, but dragonless. Power holds the usual patrician disdain for commoners like Kor and Chrissa, and most damningly Annie, who is not only a commoner but a former serf. Chrissa murmurs,
"I'm sure Goran misses those good old days too."
Her eyes narrow on the doorway of the refectory, where a single adult has entered the room. Goran, our patrician drill master, is a ruddy-faced, aging, formerly fit officer gone to seed, with traces of a dragon tongue accent that he thickens when he wants to intimidate low-born riders. The sight of him has always been unsettlingly familiar. We must have crossed paths in the years before, but he's never recognized me, and that's all that matters. Goran's loyalty to Atreus is apparent, to the ideals of the revolution, less so. Before Atreus put his foot down, Goran let power and the other patrician guardians get away with almost anything.
"Morning, guardians," Goran tells the room. "Ready to hear the bracket for today's matches?"
The tables go silent. Goran begins to read from his list.
"We've got Annie versus Darius."
Darius, one of Power's patrician friends in the Storm Scourge squadron, turns around to look at Annie, and I'm pleased to see that his usual easygoing bravado has been replaced by a furrowed brow. Annie folds her arms and glares back.
"Kor versus Rock."
Kor scowls, despite the fact that it's a decent pairing, no doubt calculating the possible combinations left to be assigned. Specifically, who might be paired with Duck.
"Next, we'll have Lee and Krissa."
Krissa lets out a groan and presses her palms to her forehead in a theatrical gesture of dismay, then locks her eyes on mine. Krissa has the kind of face, perpetually sun-flushed, framed by dark gold curls streaked with blonde, that when you stare at it, you end up allowing your gaze to linger on too long. She lifts an eyebrow playfully.
"Do your worst, Lee."
I can feel myself blushing for reasons that have nothing to do with the match. Krissa smirks, Kor rolls his eyes. After ours comes the final pairing, the one we all saw coming as soon as Goran paired me and Krissa.
"Finally, we'll have Power versus Duck."
Power lets out a trilling drum roll, but he's the only one who looks pleased. Duck has sunk low in his seat. Kor's face has tightened. Annie's arm moves ever so slightly, as if squeezing Duck's hand beneath the table. Duck is one of the only people I have ever seen Annie touch voluntarily, and she does so often. Now, as she takes his hand, he perceptibly swallows. According to Kor, they're not together. But even if they're not, it's pretty clear Duck's smitten. He has been for years, and yet still Annie touches him like this, casually, as if they're still kids. Oblivious, as far as I can tell. Annie used to touch me like that in the orphanage. She stopped when we came here. I realize that Duck is staring at me, staring at him. We look away from each other at once.
"You've got a little over an hour till the opening ceremony," Goran says. "So I'd recommend you get moving. How many of you have family coming today?"
There's a show of hands, pretty much everybody. Annie and I are the predictable exceptions. But then I see Annie's fingers lifted a bit off the table. She's studying them as if surprised herself. That doesn't make sense. How could Annie have family coming?
"Save the greetings for the end," Goran says, "but feel free to take the rest of the day off. Madam Mortmain will be doing sign-outs by the cloister entrance. Any questions?"
When there aren't, he catches my eye.
"Lee, Annie, a word."
I can't remember the last time Goran wanted to speak with Annie. We wait, seated as the others take their leave, and Goran assumes a vacant chair at the head of the table. I can almost feel the tension riddling Annie's body at his proximity. Although years have passed since he's outright bullied her, the extra chores, the arbitrarily low marks, the ridicule on the eerie, Goran has never stopped treating Annie's presence on the Kor as particularly offensive. As if her status as a former serf, compounded with her gender, were one too many of Atreus's innovations to be tolerated in one person.
"I've got notes from the Ministry, one for each of you."
He hands me mine, then Annie hers. As usual, he avoids looking at her, like she's a perversion to keep in his peripheral vision. My note is stamped with the seal of Atreus Athanatos, the first protector.
"Read them later," Goran says. "You're dismissed."
We stop together in the corridor outside to tear open our notes. Atreus has handwritten a single phrase. I read it, and for the first time today, the acid jolt of nerves hits my stomach. "Good luck, Lee." I look up. Annie is still reading, frozen. Then her shoulders go up and she tears her eyes away from her note.
"We should get to the armory," she says.
By the time we arrive, the rest of the Corps are getting ready to head underground to the dragon's nests. Annie and I make our way to the Aurelian squad's cubbies, amid riders shrugging on flame suits, hooking on their last few plates of armor, and slinging tack over their shoulders to carry down to the caves. The room smells of leather, sweat, and ash, the smells of dragon riding. I feel something pressed into my hand. Annie has passed me her note and turned away, inviting me to read it but unwilling to watch as I do. Our cubbies are side by side. In recent years, I've trained myself to stare at anything in the world, other than Annie when she's changing uniforms. Today, I stare at her note. Her message bears the seal of the Ministry of Propaganda, not the First Protector. It says, "The Ministry would like to remind Antigone Sur Aela of the intensely public nature of the obligations of Riders of the Fourth Order, and to urge her to consider carefully whether she believes her vows to serve the state would be best honored by pursuing such a public role." They want her to throw the match. Beside me, Annie has finished putting on her flame suit. Black leather, treated for heat and fire, hugs her slender frame from neckline to ankles, her braided hair a burst of red above the suit's dark silhouette. She makes no attempt to discuss the note, not while others are still around us. And so we finish arming in silence, strapping plates of armor forged out of repurposed dragon scales over our flame suits, and tightening them one by one. After the last riders have headed out and we're alone in the armory, Annie takes back her note. "What did yours say?" she asks. Atreus's note is the last thing I want to show her. I hesitate. "Please," she says quietly. Without waiting for my answer, she takes my note from the cubby. After reading it, she sinks down onto the bench beside me. "Congratulations," she says. She doesn't sound bitter or even jealous, just tired. "You're the peasant they want," she adds. Peasant was one of the words banned after the revolution, except in historical context. I don't think I've ever heard Annie say it. Not in reference to herself. Nor in reference to me, though it's been my official identity for as long as she's known me. It is an omission on her part that I've been conscious of since the orphanage, when I was less skilled at hiding where I came from, and that she's only ever since acknowledged with certain silences. I speak through a rising discomfort. "That's not how..." "Atreus would never think of it like that." Annie's head is tilted back as she studies the ceiling. "Atreus would. He needs riders in the Fourth Order who pass muster with the elites. The Fourth Order will be the rank given to the four riders who win today, signaling that of the 32 riders in the Corps, they are the four most skilled. It's the highest ranking in the fleet below First Rider." "You're talking about..." "I'm talking about succession." I freeze on the word. Annie sounds short of breath to utter it aloud. Before he ends his stewardship of the new regime, Atreus's successor will be chosen from among the best and the brightest of the Guardians. The next protector. All but officially, that selection pool will be made up of the Fourth Order. "He's thinking about succession," Annie repeats. "And he needs peasants who don't still act like it." I speak through gritted teeth as I yank the straps of an arm guard tighter on my forearm. "You don't act like it." Annie lets out a faint laugh. We both know I'm lying. I can guess as well as she what the Ministry probably has on file, that Annie is known for being too deferential, too reserved, for having trouble with situations that require public speaking. She's been at the top of the class for as long as I can remember, but almost never raises her hand. She could train past that. She could find the confidence if she tried and had the resources. But how is she supposed to look for that, to think she even should look for that if the Ministry sends her letters like this? "Something else then, something that has nothing to do with the Ministry. You said you had family coming today?" I ask the question gingerly, unsure whether I should ask it at all. Annie blinks, then shakes her head. "Not family. Friends. From my village." "My village" are two more words Annie usually avoids saying. She enunciates them carefully as if they're foreign. They wrote, she goes on, a letter. Not from the parents, they don't read. I risk a quick glance at her, her face begins to redden at read. But their son's been in school since the revolution, so he wrote, that they'd be coming. They were the family who I was with for a bit before Albans. Albans was our orphanage. She hasn't mentioned her circumstances before it, at least in front of me, in years. She fiddles with her hair, pushing a few strands out of her eyes and behind her ear. I haven't seen them since. She looks up and I realize I'm staring at her. I look away and she does too, seizing her boots, jamming one foot after another into them. I bet your making fourth order would mean a lot to them, I tell her. It would probably mean a lot to anyone coming in from the countryside to watch the tournament. You'd be... Still bent over her boots, Annie prompts me softly, I'd be what? I hear myself say it, words that would have shamed my father to hear said by anyone, let alone by me. You'd be making history. Annie has reached for her helmet, the other gloved hand braced on her knees, about to push to her feet. There's a strange curve to her smile, a lift to her eyebrows as she looks at me. When she speaks, she doesn't counter that I would, according to the low-born identity I've assumed, be making history too. As if she knows I'm not. As if she knows that I am simply hoping, desperately, hungrily, to repeat it. Let's go, Lee.
Chapter 2. The Fourth Order. Before he met the girl, the boy in the orphanage moved like a sleepwalker. Tasteless meals, hard beds on cold nights, the bullying and the beatings. He passed through all of it unseeing. Let them bully him. Let them beat him. They were nothing. Their language was the one he had listened to as he watched his family die. Instead of listening, he remembered. He remembered his family around him, his sister's laughter, his brother's teasing, his mother's voice. A world of light and warmth, great fireplaces tended by servants, ornate glass windows overlooking the fire mouth, chandeliers hanging low over tables piled high with food. He remembered the sight of his father at court, resplendent as he received his subjects. He remembered lifting aloft, the city falling below, his father's arm steadying him as the wings of his storm scourge beat the air. Her name was Alethea, and sometimes his father allowed him to bring her scraps from the table. One day, his father told him, his arm around him as the highlands of Callipolis stretched below Alethea's wings, this will be yours, if a dragon chooses you. You will learn to rule, just as I did. Did your father teach you? What he could, but much of it came naturally to me, Leo, just as it will for you. We were born to rule, just as the peasants were born to serve. He found that he could live in these memories for hours, and when they ran out, he invented futures. A dragon he would be chosen by, dragonfire he would have power over, the people who had taken everything from him, helpless and awaiting punishment. He imagined making them pay. When he did this, it kept the real world and the other memories out. Nothing hurt so much as being forced back to the present. That was what happened when he met the girl. He could see through the doorway that it was one child against two larger ones. The girl struggled. It was all familiar. But then, for the first time since he'd come to the orphanage, he found himself walking toward the violence, rather than away from it. He pulled a kitchen knife out of his pocket as he approached. The words in the other language came slowly, but they were there. Go away! At the sight of his knife, they fled. As he knelt beside the girl, he realized he recognized her. She shared courses with him at school, despite the fact that she was at least a year younger than him and his classmates. She had scrawny limbs, scraggly red-brown hair, and clothes that were well-worn even by orphanage standards. He was struck, as he looked at her, by how small she seemed. It was the first time he had ever found himself thinking this about someone else. In his family, he had been the smallest. You shouldn't have fought them, he said. They only make it harder for you when you fight them. They only hurt you more. He stopped himself. The girl shrugged and looked up at him, her face wet with tears, and he saw a bitter ferocity and determination there that he recognized. Sometimes I can't not fight, she said.
Annie. No amount of practice prepares you for the sight of the arena stands completely full, banners flapping in the wind, trumpets sounding the anthem of the revolution as the drums keep time. Ayla and I delight together in the searing blue horizon, the sharp late spring breeze, the city cheering below us as we perform the opening ceremony. Moments like this, it hits me like it did the first time, that the life I have begun to think of as routine is, in fact, extraordinary. Today, in the stands below, the people are watching commoners like themselves ride dragons. It's the kind of thing that can't help making you feel proud of your country. Even if it turns out that your country is not so proud of you. But as that thought threatens to overwhelm, I feel Ayla's body, warm through the saddle, her presence soft at the back of my mind. Hold. Be still. Not now. For as long as I can remember, Ayla has been able to temper the feelings I couldn't. Even in the very beginning, when I was still a child with lingering nightmares of dragonfire, with Ayla they fell away. A dragon's comfort for a dragon's crimes. What would people from my village think? What would my parents have thought? My brothers and sisters? Questions I've never had answered. But when I'm with Ayla, they don't matter anymore. Together with Lee Sir Palor, we lead the Aurelian squadron over the heads of the audience while the shimmering skyfish dart back and forth across the arena above us. As we practiced this morning, Kor keeps the Storm Scourge squadron high, their ash safely out of range of citizens in the stands below. Atreus begins his speech after we've landed and dismissed our dragons. Even at a distance from the palace box, it's impossible to miss Atreus's presence, his close-cut steel-grey hair, his confident pose that more than makes up for his simple, muted garb. The only thing lost is the way his gaze makes you feel powerful, important, needed. When we first met him, as children, freshly chosen by the new regime's hatchling dragons, a shiver went down my spine when he said my name. Bound for the first time to Ayla's, in Draconim, like a dragon lord's. Antigone, Sir Ayla, make your vows. What would it have been like, I can't help wondering, to receive a note of good luck from him this morning, instead of one of caution from the Ministry of Propaganda? What did Lee feel as he read those words? And is that why, standing beside me, he is able to look so unabashedly confident as he regards the waiting crowd, but confidence has never been something Lee's been short on. Notes from Atreus or no. That's been apparent from the beginning. A lot of things have been apparent from the beginning with Lee. Men and women of Kallipolis, Atreus proclaims. Welcome to the quarterfinal first rider tournament. 10 years ago, you made a historic choice. You chose to test everyone equally, to choose the best among you to become dragon riders, and to train them to lead, to bring Kallipolis into a new era of greatness, of air power in the service of what is right, of virtuous leaders and just rule. For the years between the old way of dragons and the new, you have allowed me to be your steward. Now I ask you to look to your future, to your guardians, four of whom today will become semi-finalists for First Rider
and members of the Fourth Order. In a few years, I will say, may the most virtuous guardian rule. But today I say, may the best riders win! The cheering goes up, resounding. It sets my blood on fire. I take a seat on the stone bleachers beside Duck to watch the first match. His brother Kor against Rock, who rides a storm scourge like Kor and comes from a Highland surf family, like me. Rock has stubbly grey-blonde hair, fair skin, and a hulking frame that earned him his nickname years ago. When the announcer uses his real name, riders on the Eyrie act surprised.
Good luck, Richard! They call.
Rock takes the ribbing in good cheer, exchanging a last few shoulder pumps with Lotus and Darius before heading down the stone ramp to the cave mouth alongside Kor. For the first time since our conversation, the cool reassurance of Lee's voice saying what I already knew wavers. Lee was right. I'd be making history if I made it into the Fourth Order today. But so would Rock. And who doesn't like Rock? Boisterous, steadfast, confident. The kind of peasant even the patrician kids like. It's not like my note said anything that isn't true. It's not as though I'd like public roles or want that much attention. I like winning, and I'm good at it. But there's more to this than winning a match. Making the Fourth Order would put me on display. I'd hate that. I'd be bad at it, right? But... Beside me, Duck's leg hammers the bleacher, expelling nerves for his brother. Kor and Rock down at the cave mouth are blowing into the summoning whistles built into their wristbands, filling the cave with a sound that human ears cannot hear, but their dragons have been trained to recognize. It is said that in the early days of dragon riding, riders could summon their dragons mind to mind. But that hasn't been done in centuries. The dragons emerge. Kor and Rock mount and take off. They stall above the arena at 10 meters apart, level with the wall of the outer palace, the inner palace rising still higher, and the caste supporting Pytho's keep towering over them. The bell rings. Kor advances. Rock swerves. And the realization hits me. Rock's not good enough to beat Kor. It wouldn't be an obvious call to the audience, but it's easy for me to see the signs. Rock Sir Bast moves too slowly. Kor Sir Marana keeps getting within range. Though Kor's shots are going wide, as soon as one aims true, Rock won't have time to dodge. Tournament sparring is won by hits of unsparked dragonfire, a smoky substance called ash, which has enough heat to burn and blackens tawny armor on contact. The torso counts as a kill shot, the limbs as penalties. 3 penalties serve as a kill.
Come on, Kor!
Duck has gotten to his feet beside me, leaning against the railing of the Eyrie, squinting upward against the glare of the sun. When Rock lands the first penalty, a lucky shot that blackens Kor's arm, Duck inhales like he feels the burn.
Storm scourge fire. Nothing burns so bad, they say, says Power, who's joined us on Duck's other side.
His movements on the ground are like his flying, lithe and predatorial as a slinking cat. His helmet is tucked under his arm, the sunlight glowing on his bronze skin and the shaven edge of his hair. Duck stiffens, but doesn't look left.
Care to comment, Annie? Power adds. Asking for my expertise on Storm Scourge Fire is one of Power's favorite ways to taunt me. He likes to study my face while he does it, as I stare back woodenly. After so many years, it feels like a kind of tradition. Duck's fists are curling. When we were kids, Power's allusions to what happened to my family got Duck riled enough to fight. Fights that he lost. Power's muscles are compact, his tactics and fisticuffs closer to a street rat's than a patrician child's.
What do you want?
Duck growls. Power leans close, too close to Duck. His voice is a low murmur. A long, slow roast. Duck stiffens, and I place a restraining hand on his arm.
Get away from us, I tell Power. Our conversation is quiet, but it's caught the attention of riders on nearby bleachers. Lee and Krissa are closest. At my quelling glance, Lee remains where he is, but continues to watch. Waiting, poised to move. Now Power's turned his attention from Duck to me, like a dragon on a new scent. Dark brown eyes bore into mine, teeth flashing in a smile. He inclines his head in a mockery of old regime obeisance, as if I were dragonborn. I can feel heat in my face. As Power slinks away, Duck shrugs my hand off his arm. Though his eyes have returned to his brother's match above us, his breathing is light.
Hey, Annie?
Yeah?
Want to come with me to see my family during the break?
I thought we're supposed to wait till the end.
I think I'd better do it before.
I think of Power's eyes, fury lit, and feel the helpless ache that I associate with watching Duck get hurt. Power Sir Eater has hospitalized other riders before. All right. Duck takes his eyes off the match long enough to smile crookedly at me. The wind tugs at his wavy hair as a sheepish but stubborn shrug pulls his shoulders up, like his good humor is itself an act of defiance. When I first met him, he took my hand and led me onto the roof of the cloister, just to look at the stars. At the time, I hadn't understood.
Just to see the stars?
We can see them anytime.
Not like this, Duck told me. You'll see. They're beautiful.
And I wasn't prepared for how beautiful they were. So close and still on that crenellated rooftop that they seemed near enough to touch. We got caught, but it was worth it. It was the first detention Gorin ever gave me that I completed smiling. The crowd is erupting. Kor has dived down, swept close, and landed a third penalty shot against Rock. Duck lets out a triumphant yell, his fist pumping the air. Kor Samurana landed a kill shot. The match is over. I'm the only Highlander left in the running. On the Eyrie, Kor and Rock dismount with the telltale stiffness of fresh burns. The announcer proclaims Kor Samurana as the first member of the Fourth Order, and Kor waves his arm in the air. An adrenaline high makes his grin seem a little crazed. Rock is welcomed off his dragon by his friend Lotus, who helps him limp over to the railing while his Storm Scourge takes off for the caves.
You put in a good fight, friend, Lotus says.
The son of a celebrated patrician poet, Lotus's wiry hair, brown skin, and lanky frame are a study in contrast to Rock's Highland build. Rock dusts his hands together.
Now for our wager on Lee and Krissa.
As guardians, we've taken vows forswearing the earthly pleasures of money, marriage, and offspring. But gambling still finds a way, at least where Rock and Lotus are concerned.
Yes, indeed, says Lotus. I'll raise you a dragon tongue translation that...
You know we can hear you, Krissa interrupts them. And I assume you'll be betting on me, Lotus, since I'm your squadron leader.
Lotus gulps. Krissa smirks, then catches Lee's eye and pounds a fist into her palm. Ready, Lee? Clad in scale-plated tawny armor, unsmiling, with his dark hair, grey eyes and high cheekbones, Lee looks more like a warlord from a tapestry of the Basileian Wars than an opponent to trash talk. But Krissa is undeterred. And, to my surprise, Lee lifts an eyebrow at her. A minute rejoinder that is enough to make Krissa blush. Another bet going on in the girls' dorm, how much of Krissa's flirting it will take for Lee to, in Deirdre's words, succumb. Deirdre and Alexa started it, and even Orla joined in eventually. Krissa knows about the pot and thinks it's funny. I avoid conversations about it. There have been no payouts. Lee and Krissa make their way down the ramp to the summoning point, and the sound of Deirdre's and Alexa's giggling from a nearby bleacher grates in my ears. But when they launch into the air, the eerie falls silent. All concerns with Krissa, her flirting, and Lee's inscrutable responses to it fall away at the sight of Lee flying. I'm Lee's sparring partner so often that I rarely get the chance to watch him. Lee and Palor move with a perfect balance of fluidity and precision, never overshooting, never falling short, never holding back. It's so beautiful that I find myself holding my breath, aching to get in the air myself. I want to be the one responding to their attacks and retreats, to feel the intoxication that comes from sparring with someone who pushes you to fly your best, your most daring, your hardest. Krissa is probably our strongest skyfish rider. She knows how to turn her skyfish's natural speed and flexibility to her advantage. But even this does very little against Lee's pinpoint control. Why does he keep missing openings? Rock murmurs. But he doesn't know Lee's style as I do. Lee isn't missing openings. He's just not going for anything less than a kill shot. Finally, Krissa grows impatient, veers in a roundabout, and charges. Lee swerves left a split second before Palor fires. Palor's first breath of ash is the one that wins the match. The front of Krissa's cuirass blackens. Lee won without a single penalty. When he lands and removes his helmet, his face, in contrast to Kor's startled euphoria, is completely calm. He finds Krissa, who smiles with contained disappointment as she shakes his hand. Lee maintains a look of stone-faced tranquility as the sound of cheering comes from the stands and the announcer declares him the second member of the Fourth Order. It's like he's been waiting for it. I feel a twinge of something between bitterness and admiration. It comes so naturally to him. Not just winning, but thinking he should win. And then the rejoining thought, unwanted but undeniable. Of course it does. Of course it comes naturally to him. It'd come naturally to you too if you were dragonborn. The term feels dirty. Like peasant, banned, except rather than from the lexicon, it is banned from my mind in reference to Lee. Sneaking into my thoughts now only because he looks so bloody poised. Of course, his birth was never substantiated. But it never really needed to be substantiated. And it never mattered. What matters is Lee flies well. He's a good leader and he's my friend. He deserves to win. Why should I begrudge him the comfort he has in doing it? Why should I begrudge him the First Protector's favor, this supposed slum orphan with all his unexpected confidence and grace? A 20-minute break has been called before the final two matches. Ducks against Power and mine against Darius. The riders who have already sparred are making their way down the eerie stairs to the palace entrance, where medics are ready to treat their burns during the break. Duck touches my arm. Coming?
Duck's family is sitting in the bronze section, reserved for skilled labor. Below them is the iron section for unskilled labor. High above them, on either side of the palace box, are the silver and gold sections for the spirited, meaning military and philosophical classes. Before the revolution, your family determined your class: commoner, patrician, dragonborn. But under the new regime, class is something you're tested into.
Looking for someone? Duck asks.
I'm scanning the crowd, ignoring the stares that our armor is attracting, looking for faces from my village.
Where are they?
Aren't they here? They would definitely be class bronze. Farming counts as skilled labor. This is the section where they would be sitting.
Dorian, you're here! And Annie!
The Sutters surround us. I'm embraced by Duck's mother and his two sisters while his youngest brother jumps onto a bench and launches himself into Duck's arms. The Sutters, much like Duck, have always been unquestioning in their welcome.
Exciting about Cor, isn't it? Do you think he could make first rider?
Duck squints. I wonder if we're both weighing the likelihood of Cor having a chance when Lee's a semi-finalist too.
Maybe, but first rider's more of an honorary title in times of peace.
There might be a war.
Duck's younger sister, Marina, points out. Her pigtails flop as she bounces on the balls of her feet. Like all of the Sutter children, Marina has her mother's tan complexion and her father's hazel eyes and wavy hair. Duck laughs and shakes his head.
Probably not.
He ticks off comfortably.
We've got a good relationship with Deimos. The dragons of the Iskan Archipelago are sworn neutral. The Basileian Empire's been in decline for centuries.
Duck has said nothing more than the baseline of what we've learned in class about the geopolitics of the region, but his family stares as if he'd jarred them. The Sutters own a bakery in Highmarket. They've always taken pride in Cor's and Duck's advancement, but with a certain wary incomprehension. Mr. Sutter says, with an odd strain in his deep voice,
"There's new pythos. They've got it in for us, haven't they?"
It's an attempt to keep up in displays of knowledge, so awkwardly delivered that I feel peripheral shame. Duck hoists his little brother Greg up onto his back, lines appearing on his forehead as he considers how to answer. Mr. Sutter doesn't realize it, but he's just betrayed his educational level. For years, New Pythos has been rumored to harbor survivors from the three families that escaped the Palace Day massacres, but its military might is known to be negligible. The island doesn't have dragons, or air power, not even a naval fleet, because the cast pillars that surround it make its waters nearly impassable. But the Ministry of Propaganda keeps up rumors of a new Pythian threat among the lower class metals all the same. They are, as the propaganda officials tell guardians in class, useful for inspiring patriotism. An explanation that's easier to take in stride before your class bronze dad repeats it to you. Duck agrees slowly.
That's true. There's new pythos.
Mrs. Sutter's arms, perpetually flower dusted, are placed on her hips as if to ward off the tension that she senses rising between her husband and son.
War or no, Fourth Order's an honor in its own right.
Marina pipes up eagerly.
We were learning about that in school this week. Fourth Order means they're considering you for next protector. Cor will be doing more rounds and speeches and going to fancy parties with the class golds and sort of auditioning.
They're learning about the Fourth Order in school?
The thought of children across the country talking about us fills me with anxiety. Even as I remind myself that of course they are. It's relevant to them. We're relevant to them.
The Ministry would like to remind Antigone Sir Ayla of the intensely public nature of the obligations of a Fourth Order rider. Anna, the oldest girl in the Sutter family, shudders.
That sounds terrifying. Better Cor than me.
Tall, bony, plain-faced, Anna has just summed up my own feelings. I feel a rush of fondness for her. Have you taken your metals test yet? I ask her. A year younger than us, Anna is in her final year of school, when the metals test is usually administered. She nods, then flicks her bare wrist.
Results aren't back yet. But I don't test well like Duck and Cor.
When the results are returned, Anna will wear the wristband her test assigned her. Her parents' bronze wristbands flash in the sun, the mark of skilled labor. Duck's and mine, the rarest in the city, are gold entwined with silver, indicating that when we took the test as children in the Guardian Talent Search, we tested as both philosophical and spirited. The bells are ringing. Duck's shoulders set at the sound as he remembers what comes next. Power.
Time to be getting back.
Mrs. Sutter hugs me farewell, an unthinkingly maternal act that leaves me flustered.
Good luck at your match, dear. You'll come for Midsummer this year. No excuses this time. We will drag Annie and Lee bodily from the cloister if need be, Duck assures her.
On the way back up to the Eyrie, I crane my neck to search the crowds in the bronze stands. But there's still no sign of anyone from my village. Maybe they didn't come. It'd mean a lot to the people in your village if you made Fourth Order, Lee said this morning. It's funny how much the thought of it mattering to them matters to me. I'm so absorbed straining for a sight of them that I practically stumble into Darius, my match opponent, descending from the bleachers in the gold section. He's blonde, tall, well-built, like a statue of white marble. He has friends with him, other patrician boys who've tested gold. I know most of them by sight. Guardians attend many of their classes with the gold students. They're our future peers, co-workers, underlings. Many of the officials I do rounds with when I tour the Inner Palace and other branches of government are their parents. And all of them would love for Darius Sir Myra to make the Fourth Order. Darius sees me, stops dead, and then gestures at the stone archway we're both about to walk through, the picture of gentility.
After you, Annie.
Dragons. I'll throw it. I've got to throw it. What were my vows for if not obedience to the will of the state? And the state wants this boy. It hurts, but I don't blame them. I just went cold from the thought of mere school children talking about me, didn't I? Darius isn't my favorite person, but he's decent. He'd do a fine job. Duck and Power are up next. Darius and I will close the tournament. On the Eyrie, Duck, who is now rigid with nerves, submits to his brother's checkover of his suit and his murmured advice. Power's storm scourge is large enough that he doesn't have to worry about fire conservation and precision. Eater pretty much never runs out. Duck's best strategy is to move, 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 and hopefully wear them down.
And no bloody spillovers, Cor hisses.
Most of the time, the line between our emotions and our dragons is dim, subliminal. But with violent flares of emotions, the walls break down and you share everything. Spilling over can be a rider's greatest advantage or greatest weakness. Some riders, like Power, spill over on purpose. Lee and I don't, though I'm more comfortable sharing minds with my dragon than Lee is. Duck's the sort of rider who spills over easily and shouldn't. In his and Serta's case, it never ends well. They lose control. Duck and Power walk down the ramp. Lee goes to stand beside Kor and Krissa, and though I don't usually seek his company when he's with the other two squadron leaders, I find myself moving toward him as if pulled. Stress reaction, orphanage behavior. I diagnose it even as I let myself do it. When he sees me approaching, he breaks away to join me at the Eyrie's edge. Side by side, we lean against the rail to watch. Duck and Power assume position overhead. There's silence on the Eyrie again, as there was for Lee's match, but this time it's silence of a different kind. Even Rock and Lotus have foregone making bets. And then it begins. Power Sir Eater attacks. Duck Sir Serta retreats. And then Duck sets off, Power in pursuit. But Power must figure out Duck's strategy soon enough, because we hear him shout, "Running brings me back to the good old days, Dorian." "Tune him out, Duck," Lee murmurs, his grey eyes fixed on Duck's mother-of-pearl skyfish, his fingers tight on the Eyrie railing. But Duck has never been good at tuning Power out. Sure enough, a telltale ripple goes through his skyfish. Not something the audience would notice, but we can tell it's the first sign of a spillover. And then Duck makes a jackknife turn and fires. Power dodges. The ash passes harmlessly over his shoulder, and he takes advantage of the close range to fire himself. He hits Duck on the leg, full heat. The audience gasps in appreciation, and the bell rings to mark the penalty. But on the Eyrie, muttering has broken out with a different realization. Duck's opening was wide. Power could have made a kill shot. Instead, Power went for a full heat penalty. A long, slow roast. Power's going to draw this out. The two of them back out of range while Duck opens the coolant shafts on the leg of his flame suit, a temporary pain reliever that will delay his reaction to the burn. Then they reset and advance again. By now, Duck has unmistakably spilled over. Serta is twitching at odd moments, her movements uncoordinated. Whatever emotions Duck is experiencing are now reverberating, dragon size, between the two of them. Power scores his second penalty hit barely a minute later, this time across Duck's arm and side. Again, avoiding a kill shot even though he had the opening. Again, full heat. I'm beginning to feel sick to my stomach. Storm Scourge fire. Nothing burns so bad. I can feel memories rising like a coming storm. Predictable. I should have seen it coming. The one way this morning could get harder. Not this. Not now, of all times. But once it starts happening, it always keeps happening. And so I clutch the rail and will the world around me to stay in focus. I can feel Lee's eyes, which should be on the match, on me instead. Behind us, Kor says, "Master Goran, call a foul." "It's not a foul to make a kill shot and miss, Kor." Kor rounds on our drill master. His voice is shaking. "Power is playing with his prey before he eats it." Goran's tension with the three squadron leaders has never exactly been a secret, though none of them has ever acknowledged it. Atreus, not Goran, appointed three lowborn riders, one of them female, to leadership positions within the Corps 2 years ago.
"Power has done nothing illegal," Goran says.
Kor makes a choking sound. He turns from Goran. Krissa lays a hand on his arm. "I'm going to fetch the medic," she says. "Why don't you come with me?" He shrugs her off.
"No."
I'm pretty sure my face is showing nothing, betraying nothing. But all the same, Lee has stepped closer to me so our sides are touching and places his hand beside mine on the rail. A silent invitation, where no one will see it but me. For a second, I fight the urge. But the world is going in and out. The memories are closing in. The thought of Duck up there, hurting, with no way out, threatens to overwhelm. I give in, seizing Lee's hand and holding, focusing on his grip. I'm pretty sure my nails are digging into his skin, but he doesn't pull away, only returns the pressure. I don't look at him. Overhead, Duck seems to have abandoned, or perhaps forgotten, his original strategy of keeping distance. He and Power are circling each other, Duck's skyfish rippling with their shared emotions. Within seconds, Power takes his third and final shot. Though it need only be a partial hit to finish the match, he makes it a kill shot anyway. Duck is engulfed in thick black smoke. When it clears, his silhouette is stiff on his dragon. They descend slowly behind Power and Eta to the eyrie. Power dismounts. He's smiling.
"Hope is all right," he says. "That came out a bit more forcefully than I intended."
Kor launches for him with a wordless cry. Lee's hand tears free of mine to help hold him back. Goran and the medic cut the straps tying Duck's boots to his stirrups and ease him from Serta's back. Her gaze is vacant, the expression of a dragon whose rider is unconscious. I take in the sight of Duck's limp figure, the smell of smoke, and feel the panic roll over me in cold waves. Nothing burns like storm scourge fire. Lee steps forward and then, when he realizes I am moving with him, turns and catches me across the waist, holding me back. He turns me toward him, seeking my eyes.
"Annie."
"I have to..." I'm straining to get past him, unable to speak, barely able to see Duck for what I can no longer fight remembering. The memories of Stormscourge fire engulfing my whole world while I watched and could do nothing. Then Lee's blazing eyes find mine. The world stills. Everything else falls away.
"I'll take care of him. You need to go."
At first I don't understand. And then it comes rushing back. My match. I still have a match. A match that I'm not supposed to win. A match that no one in my village came to see.